In the town of Baseville, they passed a fast food place that advertised chicken biscuits and 24-hour service. Leon turned around. "I could use the ladies' room," Inez said. There were no other customers inside at 3:15 in the morning. Butch rolled his mother to a table near the front, and they ate in silence. The van with Raymond's coffin was less than 30 feet away. Inez managed a few bites, then lost her appetite. Butch and Leon ate like refugees. They entered Ford County just after 5 a.m. Still very dark, the roads empty. They drove to Pleasant Ridge, in the north end of the county, to a small Pentecostal church where they parked in the gravel lot and waited. At the first hint of sunlight, they heard an engine start somewhere in the distance. "Wait here," Leon said to Butch, then left the van and disappeared. Behind the church there was a cemetery, and at the far end of it a backhoe had just begun digging the grave. The backhoe was owned by a cousin's boss. At 6:30, several men from the church arrived and went to the gravesite. Leon drove the van down a dirt trail and stopped near the backhoe, which had finished its digging and was now just waiting. The men pulled the coffin from the van. Butch and Leon gently placed their mother's wheelchair on the ground and pushed her as they followed the coffin. They lowered it with ropes, and when it settled onto the 4x4 studs at the bottom, they withdrew the ropes. The preacher read a short verse of scripture, then said a prayer. Leon and Butch shoveled some dirt onto the coffin, then thanked the men for their assistance. As they drove away, the backhoe was refilling the grave. The house was empty. No concerned neighbors waiting, no relatives there to mourn. They unloaded Inez and rolled her into the house and into her bedroom. She was soon fast asleep. The four boxes were placed in a storage shed where the contents would weather and fade along with the memories of Raymond. It was decided that Butch would stay home that day to care for Inez and to ward off reporters. There had been many calls in the past week, and someone was bound to show up with a camera. He worked at a sawmill, and his boss would understand. Leon drove to Clanton and stopped on the edge of town to fill up with gas. At 8 a.m. sharp, he pulled into the lot at McBride Upholstery and returned the van. An employee explained that Mr. McBride wasn't in yet, was probably still at the coffee shop, and usually got to work around 9 a.m. Leon handed over the keys, thanked the employee, and left. He drove to the lamp factory east of town and punched the clock at 8:30, as always. Fish Files. After 17 years of grinding out a living in a law practice that, for some forgotten reason, had gradually been reduced to little more than bankruptcy and divorce work, it was astonishing even years later that one phone call could change so much. As a busy lawyer who handled the desperate problems of others, Max Stafford had made and received all sorts of life-altering phone calls. Calls to initiate or settle divorces, calls to pass along grim rulings on child custody, calls to inform honest men that they would not be repaid. Unpleasant calls, for the most part. He had never thought about the possibility that one call could so quickly and dramatically lead to his own divorce and bankruptcy. It came during lunch on a bleak and dreary and otherwise slow Tuesday in early February, and because it was just afternoon, Mac took it himself. Frida, the secretary, had stepped out for an errand and a sandwich, and since his little firm employed no one else, Mac was left to guard the phone. As things evolved, the fact that he was alone was crucial. If Frida had answered it, there would have been questions and lots of them. In fact, most of what followed would not have happened had she been at her post in the reception area near the front door of a little shop known as Law Offices of Jacob McKinley Stafford. After the third ring, Mac grabbed the phone on his desk in the back and offered the usual brusque law office. He received on average 50 calls a day, most from warring spouses and disgruntled creditors, and he had long since developed the habit of disguising his voice and withholding his name when forced to take calls unfiltered by Frida. He hated answering the phone cold, but he also needed the business. Like every other lawyer in Clanton, and there were plenty, he never knew when the next call might be the big one, the big catch, the big case that could lead to a handsome fee and maybe even a way out. Mac had been dreaming of such a phone call for more years than he cared to admit. And on this cold winter day, with a slight chance of snow in the air, the call finally arrived. A male voice with a different accent, from somewhere up north, replied, "Yes, Mr. Mac Stafford, please." The voice was too polished and too far away to worry him, so he replied, "This is Mac." "Mac Stafford, the attorney." "Correct. Who's calling?" "My name is Marty Rosenberg, and I'm with the Durbin & Lang firm in New York." "New York City?" Mac asked, and much too quickly. Of course it was New York City. Though his practice had never taken him anywhere near the big city, he certainly knew of Durbin & Lang. Every lawyer in America had at least heard of the firm. "That's correct. May I call you Mac?" The voice was quick but polite, and Mac suddenly had a visual of Mr. Rosenberg sitting in a splendid office with art on the walls and associates and secretaries scurrying about, tending to his needs. Yet in the midst of such power, he wanted to be friendly. A wave of insecurity swept over Mac as he looked around his dingy little room and wondered if Mr. Rosenberg had already decided he was just another small-town loser because he answered his own phone. "Sure, and I'll just call you Marty." "Great. Sorry, Marty, to grab the phone, but my secretary stepped out for lunch." It was important for Mac to clear the air and let this guy know that he was a real lawyer with a real secretary. "Yes, well, I forgot that you're an hour behind us," Marty said, with a trace of contempt, the first hint that perhaps they were separated by far more than just a simple hour. "What can I do for you?" Mac asked, seizing control of the conversation. Enough of the small talk. Both were busy, important lawyers. His mind was in overdrive as he tried to think of any case, any file, any legal matter that could conceivably merit interest from such a large and prestigious law firm. Marty said, "Well, we represent a Swiss company that recently purchased most of the Tenzo Group out of South Korea. You're familiar with Tenzo?" "Of course," Mac replied quickly, while his mind racked its memory for some recollection of Tenzo. It did indeed ring a bell, though a very distant one. Marty went on, "And according to some old Tenzo records, you at one time represented some loggers who claimed to have been injured by defective chainsaws manufactured by a Tenzo division in the Philippines." Oh, that Tenzo! Now Mac was in the game. Now he remembered, though the details were still not at his fingertips. The cases were old, stale, and almost forgotten, because Mac had tried his best to forget them. Terrible injuries, he said anyway. Terrible as they might have been, they had never been so grievous as to prompt Mac to actually file suit. He had signed them up years earlier but lost interest when he couldn't bluff a quick settlement. His theory of liability was shaky at best. The Tenzo chainsaws in question actually had an impressive safety record. And, most important, product liability litigation was complicated, expensive, way over his head, and usually involved jury trials, which Mac had always tried to avoid. There was comfort in filing divorces and personal bankruptcies and doing an occasional will or deed. Little in the way of fees, but he and most of the other lawyers in Clanton could eke out a living while avoiding almost all risk. "We have no record of any lawsuits being filed down there," Marty was saying. "Not yet," Mac said, with as much bluster as he could manage. "How many of these cases do you have, Mac?"
4,
he said, though he wasn't certain of the exact number.
"Yes, that's what our records show. We have the 4 letters you sent the company some time back. However, there doesn't seem to have been much activity since the original correspondence."
"The cases are active," Mac said, and for the most part it was a lie. The office files were still open, technically, but he hadn't touched them in years. Fish files, he called them. The longer they sit there untouched, the more they stink. "We have a 6-year statute of limitations," he said, somewhat smugly, as if he just might crank up things tomorrow and commence all manner of hardball litigation. "Kind of unusual, if I must say so," Marty mused. "Not a thing in the files in over 4 years." In an effort to steer the conversation away from his own procrastination, Mac decided to get to the point.
Where is this going, Marty?
Well, our Swiss client wants to clean up the books and get rid of as much potential liability as possible. They're European, of course, and they don't understand our tort system. Frankly, they're terrified of it.
With good reason, Mac jumped in, as if he routinely extracted huge sums of money from corporate wrongdoers.
They want these things off the books, Mac, and they've instructed me to explore the possibility of settlement.
Mac was on his feet, phone wedged between his jaw and his shoulder, his pulse racing, his hand scrambling for a fish file in a pile of debris on the sagging credenza behind his desk, a frantic search for the names of his clients who'd been maimed years ago by the sloppy design and production of Tenso chainsaws.
Say what? Settlement? As in money changing hands from the rich to the poor?
Mac couldn't believe what he was hearing.
Are you there, Mac? Marty asked.
Oh, yes, just flipping through a file here. Let's see, the chainsaws were all the same, a model 58X, 24-inch with the nickname of Laser Cut, a heavy-duty pro model that for some reason had a chain guard that was defective and dangerous.
You got it, Mac. I'm not calling to argue about what might have been defective. That's what trials are for. I'm talking about settlement, Mac. Are you with me?
Damn right I am, Mac almost blurted.
Certainly. I'm happy to talk settlement. You obviously have something in mind. Let's hear it.
He was seated again, tearing through the file, looking for dates, praying that the 6-year statute of limitations had not expired on any of these now critically important cases.
Yes, Mac, I have some money to offer. But I must caution you up front that my client has instructed me not to negotiate. If we can settle these matters quickly and very quietly, then we'll write the checks. But when the dickering starts, the money disappears. Are we clear on this, Mac?
Oh, yes. Crystal clear. Mr. Marty Rosenberg in his fancy office high above Manhattan had no idea how quickly and quietly and cheaply he could make the fish files disappear.
Mac would take anything. His badly injured clients had long since stopped calling.
Agreed, Mac said.
Marty shifted gears and his words became even crisper. We figure it would cost $100,000 to defend these cases in federal court down there, assuming we could lump them all together and have just one trial. This is obviously a stretch since the cases have not been filed, and frankly, litigation seems unlikely given the thinness of the file. Add another $100,000 for the injuries, none of which have been documented, mind you, but we understand that some fingers and hands have been lost. Anyway, we'll pay $100,000 per claim, throw in the cost of defense, and the total on the table comes to $500,000.
Mac's jaw dropped, and he almost swallowed the phone.
He was prepared to demand at least 3 times any amount Marty first mentioned, the usual lawyer's routine, but for a few seconds he could neither speak nor breathe.
Marty went on.
All upfront money, confidential, no admission of liability, with the offer good for 30 days until March 10.
An offer of $10,000 per claim would have been a shock and a windfall.
Mac gasped for air and tried to think of a response.
Marty went on.
Again, Mac, we're just trying to clean up the balance sheet. What do you think?
What do I think? Mac repeated to himself.
I think my cut is 40%, and the math is easy. I think that last year I grossed $95,000 and burned half of it in overhead, Frieda's salary and the office bills, which left me with a net of about $46,000 before taxes, which I think was slightly less than my wife earned as an assistant principal at Clanton High School. I'm thinking a lot of things right now. Some really random stuff like, 1, is this a joke? 2, who from my law school class could be behind this? 3, assuming it's real, how can I keep the wolves away from this wonderful fee? 4, my wife and daughters would burn through this money in less than a month. 5, Frieda would demand a healthy bonus. 6, how can I approach my chainsaw clients after so many years of neglect? And so on. I'm thinking about a lot of stuff, Mr. Rosenberg.
That's very generous, Marty, Mac managed to say, finally. I'm sure my clients will be pleased.
After the shock, his brain was beginning to focus again. Good. Do we have a deal?
Well, let me see. I, of course, will need to run this by my clients, and that might take a few days. Can I call you in a week?
Of course, but we're anxious to wrap this up, so let's hurry. And Mac, I cannot stress enough our desire for confidentiality. Can we agree to bury these settlements, Mac?
For that kind of money, Mac would agree to anything.
I understand, he said. Not a word to anyone.
And Mac meant it. He was already thinking of all the people who would never know about this lottery ticket.
Great, Marty said. You'll call me next week.
You got it, Marty. And listen, my secretary has a big mouth. It's best if you don't call here again. I'll call you next Tuesday.
What time?
How about 11, Eastern?
You got it, Marty.
They swapped phone numbers and addresses and said goodbye. According to the digital timer on Mac's phone, the call lasted 8 minutes and 40 seconds. The phone rang again just after Marty hung up, but Mac could only stare at it. He wouldn't dare push his luck. Instead, he walked to the front of his office, to the large front window with his name painted on it. And he looked across the street to the Ford County Courthouse, where, at that moment, some garden-variety, ham-and-egg lawyers were upstairs munching on cold sandwiches in the judges' chambers and haggling over another $50 a month in child support and whether the wife should get the Honda and hubby should get the Toyota. He knew they were there because they were always there, and he was often with them. And down the hall in the clerk's office, more lawyers were poring over land records and lien books and dusty old plats while they bantered back and forth in their tired humor, jokes, stories, and quips he'd heard 1,000 times. A year or two earlier, someone had counted 51 lawyers in the town of Clanton, and virtually all were packed together around the square, their offices facing the courthouse. They ate in the same cafes, met in the same coffee shops, drank in the same bars, hustled the same clients, and almost all of them harbored the same gripes and complaints about their chosen profession. Somehow, a town of 10,000 people provided enough conflict to support 51 lawyers, when in reality, less than half that number were needed. Mac had rarely felt needed. To be sure, he was needed by his wife and daughters, though he often wondered if they wouldn't be happy without him. But the town and its legal needs would survive nicely without him. In fact, he'd realized long ago that if he suddenly closed shop, few would notice. No client would go without representation. The other lawyers would secretly grin because they had one less competitor. No one in the courthouse would miss him after a month or so. This had saddened him for many years. But what really depressed him was not the present or the past, but the future. The prospect of waking up one day at the age of 60 and still trudging to the office, no doubt the same office, and filing no-fault divorces and nickel-and-dime bankruptcies on behalf of people who could barely pay his modest fees, well, it was enough to sour his mood every day of his life. It was enough to make Mac a very unhappy man. He wanted out, and he wanted out while he was still young. A lawyer named Wilkins passed by on the sidewalk without glancing at Mac's window. Wilkins was a jackass who worked 4 doors down. Years ago, over a late afternoon drink with 3 other lawyers, one of whom was Wilkins, Mac had talked too much and divulged the details of his grand scheme to make a killing with chainsaw litigation. Of course, the scheme went nowhere, and when Mac could not convince any of the more competent trial lawyers in the state to sign on, his chainsaw files began to stink. Wilkins, ever the prick, would catch Mac in the presence of other lawyers and say something like, "Hey, Mac, how's that chainsaw class action coming along?" Or, "Hey, Mac, you settle those chainsaw cases yet?" With time, though, even Wilkins forgot about the cases. "Hey, Wilkins, take a look at this settlement, old boy. $500,000 on the table. $200,000 of it goes into my pocket. At least that much, maybe more. Hey, Wilkins, you haven't cleared $200,000 in the last 5 years combined." But Mac knew that Wilkins would never know. No one would know. And that was fine with Mac. Frida would soon make her usual noisy entrance. Mac hurried to his desk, called the number in New York, asked for Marty Rosenberg, and when his secretary answered, Mac hung up and smiled. He checked his afternoon schedule, and it was as dreary
as the weather. One new divorce at 2:30 and an ongoing one at 4:30. There was a list of 15 phone calls to make, not a single one of which he looked forward to. The fish files on the credenza were festering in neglect. He grabbed his overcoat, left his briefcase, and sneaked out the back door. His car was a small BMW with 160,000 miles on the odometer. The lease expired in 5 months, and he was already fretting about what to drive next. Since lawyers, regardless of how broke they may be, are supposed to drive something impressive, he had been quietly shopping around, careful to keep things to himself. His wife would not approve of whatever he chose, and he simply wasn't ready for that fight. His favorite beer trail began at Parker's Country Store, 8 miles south of town, in a community where no one ever recognized him. He bought a 6-pack of bright green bottles, imported, good stuff for this special day, and continued south on the narrow back roads until there was no other traffic. He listened to Jimmy Buffett sing about sailing and drinking rum and living a life that Mac had been dreaming about for some time. In the summer before he started law school, he spent 2 weeks scuba diving in the Bahamas. It had been his first trip out of the country, and he longed to do it again. Over the years, as the tedium of practicing law overwhelmed him, and as his marriage became less and less fulfilling, he listened to Buffett more and more. He could handle life on a sailboat. He was ready. He parked in a secluded picnic area at Lake Chitala, the largest body of water within 50 miles, and left the engine running, the heat on, a window crack. He sipped beer and gazed across the lake, a busy place in the summer with ski boats and small catamarans, but deserted in February. Marty's voice was still fresh and clear. Their conversation was still easy to replay, almost word for word. Mac talked to himself, then sang along with Buffett. This was his moment, an opportunity that in all likelihood would never pass his way again. Mac finally convinced himself that he wasn't dreaming, that the money was on the table. The math was calculated, then recalculated over and over. A light snow began, flurries that melted as soon as they touched the ground. Even the chance of an inch or two thrilled the town, and now that a few flakes were falling, he knew that the kids at school were standing at the windows, giddy at the thought of being dismissed and sent home to play. His wife was probably calling the office with instructions to go fetch the girls. Frida was looking for him. After the third beer, he fell asleep. He missed his 2:30 appointment, and he didn't care. He missed his 4:30 as well. He saved one beer for the return trip, and at 5:15, he walked through the rear door of his office and was soon face to face with an extremely agitated secretary. "Where have you been?" Frida demanded. "I went for a drive," he said, as he removed his overcoat and hung it in the hallway. She followed him into his office, hands on hips, just like his wife. "You missed 2 appointments, the Maddens and the Garners, and they are not happy at all. You smell like a brewery." "They make beer at breweries, don't they?" "I suppose. That's $1,000 in fees you just pissed away." "So what?" He fell into his chair, knocked some files off his desk. "So what? So we need all the fees we can get around here. You're in no position to run off clients. We didn't cover the overhead last month, and this month is even slower." Her voice was pitched, shrill, rapid, and the venom had been building for hours. "There's a stack of bills on my desk and no money in the bank. The other bank would like some progress on that line of credit you decided to create for some reason." He asked, "How long have you worked here, Frida?"
5 years.
"That's long enough. Pack your things and get out. Now." She gasped. Both hands flew up to her mouth. She managed to say,
"You're firing me?"
"No, I'm cutting back on the overhead. I'm downsizing." She fought back quickly, laughing in a loud, nervous cackle. "And who'll answer the phone, do all the typing, pay the bills, organize the files, babysit the clients, and keep you out of trouble?" "No one." "You're drunk, Mac." "Not drunk enough." "You can't survive without me." "Please, just leave. I'm not going to argue." "You'll lose your ass," she growled. "I've already lost it.
Well, now you're losing your mind.
That too, please. She huffed off, and Mac put his feet on his desk. She slammed drawers and stomped around the front for 10 minutes, then yelled,
"You're a lousy son of a bitch, you know that?"
"Got that right. Goodbye." The front door slammed, and all was quiet. The first step had been taken. An hour later, he left again. It was dark and cold, and the snow had given up. He was still thirsty and didn't want to go home, nor did he want to be seen in one of the three bars in downtown Clanton. The Riviera Motel was east of town on the highway to Memphis. It was a 1950s-style dump with tiny rooms, some known to be available by the hour, and a small cafe and a small lounge. Mac parked himself at the bar and ordered a draft beer. There was country music from a jukebox, college basketball on the screen above, and the usual collection of low-budget travelers and bored locals, all well over the age of 50. Mac recognized no one but the bartender, an old-timer whose name escaped him. Mac was not exactly a regular at the Riviera. He asked for a cigar, lit it, sipped his beer, and after a few minutes pulled out a small notepad and began scribbling. To hide much of his financial mess from his wife, he had organized his law firm as a limited liability company, or an LLC, the current rage among lawyers. He was the sole owner, and most of his debts were gathered there. A $25,000 line of credit that was 6 years old and showing no signs of being reduced, 2 law firm credit cards that were used for small expenses, both personal and business, and were also maxed out at the $10,000 limit and kept afloat with minimum payments, and the usual office debts for equipment. The LLC's largest liability was a $120,000 mortgage on the office building Mac had purchased 8 years earlier against the rather vocal objections of his wife. The monthly strain was $1,400, and not eased one bit by the empty space on the second floor Mac was certain he would rent to others when he bought the place. On this wonderful, dreary day in February, Mac was 2 months in arrears on his office mortgage. He ordered another beer as he added up the misery. He could bankrupt it all, give his files to a lawyer friend, and walk away a free man with no trace of embarrassment or humiliation because he, Mac Stafford, wouldn't be around for folks to point at and whisper about. The office was easy. The marriage would be another matter. He drank until 10, then drove home. He pulled into the driveway of his modest little home in an old section of Clanton, turned off the engine and the lights, sat behind the wheel, and stared at the house. The lights in the den were on. She was waiting. They had purchased the house from her grandmother not long after they were married 15 years earlier, and for about 15 years now, Lisa had wanted something larger. Her sister was married to a doctor, and they lived in a fine home out by the country club where all the other doctors and bankers and some of the lawyers lived. Life was much better out there because the homes were newer, with pools and tennis courts and a golf course just around the corner. For much of his married life, Mac had been reminded that they were making little progress in their climb up the social ladder. Progress? Mac knew they were actually sliding. The longer they stayed in Granny's house, the smaller it became. Lisa's family had owned Clanton's only concrete plant for generations, and though this kept them at the top of the town's social class, it did little for their bank accounts. They were afflicted with family money, a status that had much to do with snobbery and precious little to do with hard assets. Marrying a lawyer seemed like a good move at the time, but 15 years later she was having doubts, and Mac knew it. The porch light came on. If the fight was to be like most others, the girls, Helen and Margot, would have front row seats. Their mother had probably been making calls and throwing things for several hours, and in the midst of her rampage, she made sure the girls knew who was right and who was wrong. Both were now young teenagers and showing every sign of growing up to be just like Lisa. Mac certainly loved them, but he had already made the decision on beer number 3 at the lake that he could live without them. The front door opened, then there she was. She took one step across the narrow porch, crossed her bare arms, and glared across the frigid lawn directly into the shivering eyes of Mac. He stared back, then opened the driver's door and got out of the car. He slammed the door, and she let loose with a nasty, "Where have you been?" "At the office," he shot back as he took a step and told himself to walk carefully and not stagger like a drunk. His mouth was full of peppermint gum, not that he planned to fool anyone. The driveway declined slightly from the house to the street. "Where have you been?" she inquired again, even louder. "Please, the neighbors." He didn't see the patch of ice between his car and hers, and by the time he discovered it, things were out of control. He flipped forward, yelping, and crashed into the rear bumper of her car with the front of his head. His world went black for a few moments, and when he came to, he heard frantic female voices, one of whom announced, "He's drunk." "Thanks, Lisa." His head was split, and his eyes wouldn't focus. She hovered over him, saying things like, "There's blood, oh my God," and, "Your father's drunk," and, "Go call 911. Mercifully, he blacked out again, and when he could hear again, there was a male voice in control, Mr. Browning from next door. He said, "Watch the ice, Lisa, and hand me that blanket. There's a lot of blood." "He's been drinking," Lisa said, "always looking for allies." "He probably doesn't feel a thing," Mr. Browning added helpfully. He and Mac had feuded for years. Though he was groggy and could have said something, Mac decided, lying there in the cold, to just close his eyes and let someone else worry about him. Before long, he heard an ambulance. He actually enjoyed the hospital. The drugs were delightful, the nurses thought he was cute, and it provided a perfect excuse to stay away from the office. He had 6 stitches and a nasty bruise on his forehead, but, as Lisa had informed someone on the phone when she thought he was asleep, there was no additional brain damage. Once it was determined that his wounds were slight, she avoided the hospital and kept the girls away. He was in no hurry to leave, and she was in no hurry for him to come home. But after 2 days, the doctor ordered his release. As he was gathering his things and saying goodbye to the nurses, Lisa entered his room and shut the door. She sat in the only chair, crossed her arms and legs as if she planned to stay for hours, and Mac relaxed on the bed. The last dose of Percocet was still lingering, and he felt wonderfully lightheaded. "You fired Frida," she said, jaw clenched, eyebrows arched. "Yes, why?" "Because I got tired of her mouth. What do you care? You hate Frida. What will happen to the office?" "It'll be a hell of a lot quieter for one thing. I've fired secretaries before. It's no big deal." A pause as she uncrossed her arms and began twirling a strand of hair. This meant she was pondering serious stuff and was about to unload it. She said, "We have an appointment with Dr. Juanita tomorrow at 5, she announced. Done deal, nothing to negotiate. Dr. Juanita was one of 3 licensed marriage counselors in Clanton. Mac knew them professionally through his work as a divorce lawyer. He knew them personally because Lisa had dragged him to all 3 for counseling. He needed counseling. She, of course, did not. Dr. Juanita always sided with the women, and so her selection was no surprise. "How are the girls?" Mac asked. He knew the answer would be ugly, but if he didn't ask, then she would later complain to Dr. Juanita that he didn't even ask about the girls. Humiliated. Their father comes home drunk late at night, falls in the driveway, cracks his skull, gets hauled to the hospital where his blood alcohol is twice the legal limit. Everybody in town knows it. If everybody knows it, then it's because you've spread the word. Why can't you just keep your mouth shut? Her face flashed red, and her eyes glowed with hatred. You're pathetic. You're a miserable, pathetic drunk. You know that? I disagree. How much are you drinking? Not enough. You need help, Mac. Serious help. And I'm supposed to get this help from Dr. Juanita? She suddenly bolted to her feet and stormed for the door. I'm not going to fight in a hospital, she said. Of course not. You prefer to fight at home in front of the girls. She yanked open the door and said, 5 o'clock tomorrow, and you'd better be there. I'll think about it. And don't come home tonight. She slammed the door and Mac heard her heels click angrily away. The first client in Mac's chainsaw class action scheme was a career pulpwood cutter by the name of Odell Grove. Almost 5 years earlier, Mr. Grove's 19-year-old son needed a quick divorce and found his way to Mac's office. In the course of representing the kid, himself a pulpwood cutter, Mac learned of Odell's encounter with a chainsaw that proved more dangerous than most. During routine operations, the chain snapped, the guard failed, and Odell lost his left eye. He wore a patch now, and it was the patch that helped identify this long-forgotten client when Mac entered the truck stop cafe outside the small town of Caraway. It was a few minutes past 8, the morning after Mac's discharge from the hospital, the morning after he'd slept at the office. He had sneaked by the house after the girls left for school and picked up some clothes. To mix with the locals, he was wearing boots and a camouflage suit he'd put on occasionally when hunting deer. The fresh wound on his forehead was covered with a green wool ski cap pulled low, but he couldn't hide all the bruising. He was taking painkillers and had a buzz. The pills were giving him the courage to somehow wade through this unpleasant encounter. He had no choice. Odell, with his black eye patch, was eating pancakes and talking loudly 3 tables away, and never glanced at Mac. According to the file, they had met at the same truck stop 4 years and 10 months earlier, when Mac first informed Odell that he had a good, solid case against the maker of the chainsaw. Their last contact had been almost 2 years ago, when Odell called the office with some rather pointed inquiries about the progress of his good, solid case. After that, the file became odorous. Mac drank coffee at the counter, glanced at a newspaper, and waited for the early morning crowd to leave for work. Eventually, Odell and his 2 co-workers finished breakfast and stopped at the cash register. Mac left $1 for his coffee and followed them outside. As they headed for their pulpwood truck, Mac swallowed hard and said, "Odell!" All 3 stopped as Mac hustled over for a friendly hello. "Odell, it's me, Mac Stafford. I handle a divorce for your son, Luke." "The lawyer?" Odell asked, confused. He took in the boots, the hunting garb, the ski cap not far above the eyes. "Sure, from Clanton. You got a minute?" "What?" "Just take a minute. A small business matter." Odell looked at the other 2, and all 3 shrugged. "We'll wait in the truck," one of them said. Like most men who spend their time deep in the woods knocking down trees, Odell was thick through the shoulders and chest with massive forearms and weathered hands. And with his one good eye, he was able to convey more contempt than most men could dish out with 2. "What is it?" he snarled, then spat. A toothpick was stuck in the corner of his mouth. There was a scar on his left cheek, courtesy of Tenzo. The accident had cost him 1 eyeball and a month's worth of pulpwood. A little more. Mac said, "I'm winding down my practice." "What the hell does that mean?" "Means I'm closing up the office. I think I might be able to squeeze some money out of your case."
"I think I've heard that before."
"Here's the deal. I can get you $25,000 cash, hard cash, in 2 weeks, but only if you keep it extremely confidential. I mean, graveyard quiet. You can't tell a soul." For a man who'd never seen $5,000 in cash, the prospect was instantly appealing. Odell glanced around to make sure they were alone. He worked the toothpick as if it helped him think.
"Something don't smell right," he said, his eye patch twitching.
"It's not complicated, Odell. It's a quick settlement because the company that made the chainsaw is getting bought out by another company. Happens all the time. They'd like to forget about these old claims."
"All nice and legal?"
Odell asked with suspicion, as if this lawyer couldn't be trusted.
"Of course.
They'll pay the money, but only if it's kept confidential. Plus, think about all the problems you'd face if folks knew you had that kind of cash."
Odell looked straight at the pulpwood truck and his 2 buddies sitting inside. Then he thought of his wife and her mother and his son in jail for drugs and his son who was unemployed. And before long, he thought of lots of people who'd happily help him go through the money. Mac knew what he was thinking and added, "Cold cash, Odell.
from my pocket to yours, and nobody will know anything. Not even the IRS.
No chance of getting more?
Odell asked. Mac frowned and kicked a rock. Not a dime, Odell. Not a dime. It's $25,000 or nothing. And we have to move quick. I can hand you the cash in less than a month.
What do I have to do?
Meet me here Friday of next week, 8 a.m. I'll need one signature, then I can get the money.
How much you making off this?
It's not important, Odell. You want the cash or not.
Well, ain't much money for an eyeball.
You're right about that, but it's all you're going to get. Yes or no? Odell spat again and moved the toothpick from one side to the other. Finally, he said,
I reckon.
Good. Next Friday, 8 a.m., here and come along. During the first meeting years earlier, Odell had mentioned that he knew of another pulpwood cutter who'd lost a hand while using the same model Tenso chainsaw. This second injury had inspired Mac to begin dreaming of a broader attack, a class action on behalf of dozens, maybe hundreds of maimed plaintiffs. He could almost feel the money years earlier. Plaintiff number two had been tracked down next door in Polk County, in a desolate hollow deep in a pine forest. His name was Gerald Baker, age 31, a former logger who'd been unable to pursue that career with only one hand. Instead, he and a cousin built a methamphetamine lab in their double-wide trailer, and Gerald the chemist made much more money than Gerald the logger. His new career, however, proved just as dangerous, and Gerald narrowly escaped a fiery death when their lab exploded, incinerating the equipment, the inventory, the trailer, and the cousin. Gerald was indicted, sent to prison, and from there wrote several unanswered letters to his class action lawyer, seeking updates on the good, solid case they had against Tenso. He was paroled after a few months and rumored to be back in the area. Mac had not spoken to him in at least 2 years, and speaking to him now would be a challenge, if not an impossibility. Gerald's mother's house was abandoned. A neighbor down the road was most uncooperative until Mac explained that he owed Gerald $300 and needed to deliver a check. Since it was likely that Gerald owed money to most of his mother's neighbors, a few details emerged. Mac certainly didn't appear to be a drug agent, a process server, or a parole officer. The neighbor pointed up the road and over the hill, and Mac followed his directions. He dropped more hints about delivering money as he worked his way deeper into the pine forest of Polk County. It was almost noon when the gravel road came to a dead end. An ancient mobile home sat on cinder blocks wrapped in wild vines. Mac, a .38 caliber handgun in one pocket, slowly approached the trailer. The door opened slowly, sagging on its hinges. Gerald stepped onto the rickety plank porch and glared at Mac, who froze 20 feet away. Gerald was shirtless but wearing ink, his arms and chest adorned with a colorful collection of prison tattoos. His hair was long and dirty, his thin body no doubt ravaged by meth. He'd lost his left hand, thanks to Tenso, but in his right he held a sawed-off shotgun. He nodded, but didn't speak. His eyes were deep-set, ghost-like. I'm Mac Stafford, a lawyer from Clanton. I believe you're Gerald Baker, aren't you? Mac half expected the shotgun to come up firing, but it didn't move. Oddly enough, the client smiled, a toothless offering that was more frightening than the weapon. That's me, he grunted. They talked for 10 minutes, a surprisingly civil exchange, given the setting and given their history. As soon as Gerald realized he was about to receive $25,000 in cash and that no one would know about it, he turned into a little boy and even invited Mac inside. Mac declined. By the time they settled into their leather seats and faced the counselor across the desk, Dr. Juanita had been fully briefed on all issues and only pretended to be open-minded. Mac almost asked how many times the girls had chatted, but his strategy was all about avoiding conflict. After a few comments designed to relax the husband and wife and to instill confidence and warmth, Dr. Juanita invited them to say something. Not surprisingly, Lisa went first. She prattled nonstop for about 15 minutes about her unhappiness, her emptiness, her frustrations, and she minced no words in describing her husband's lack of affection and ambition and his increasing reliance upon alcohol. Mac's forehead was black and blue, and a fairly large white bandage covered a third of it. So not only was he described as a drunk, he in fact looked like one. He bit his tongue, listened, tried to appear dismal and depressed. When it was his turn to speak, he expressed some of the same concerns but didn't drop any bombs. Most of their problems were caused by him, and he was ready to take the blame. When he finished, Dr. Juanita split them up. Lisa left first and went back to the lobby to flip through some magazines while she reloaded. Mac was left to face the counselor alone. The first time he'd endured this torture, he'd been nervous. Now, though, he had been through so many sessions that he really didn't care. Nothing he said would help save their marriage, so why say much at all? "I have a sense that you want out of this marriage," Dr. Juanita began softly, wisely, eyeing him carefully. "I want out because she wants out. She wants a bigger life, a bigger house, a bigger husband. I'm just too small. Do you and Lisa ever share a laugh? Maybe if we're watching something funny on television, I laugh, she laughs, the girls laugh. How about sex? Well, we're both 42 years old and we average about once a month, which is sad because an encounter takes 5 minutes, max. There's no passion, no romance, just something to knock the edge off. Pretty methodical, like connect the dots. I get the impression she could forget the entire business." Dr. Juanita took some notes, in much the same manner that Mac took notes with a client who said nothing, but something needed to be written nonetheless. "How much are you drinking?" she asked. "Not nearly as much as she says. She's from a family of non-drinkers, so a 3-beer night is a regular bender. But you are drinking too much. I came home the other night, the day it snowed, slipped on some ice, hit my head, and now most of Clanton has heard that I staggered home drunk and fell out in my driveway, cracked my skull, and now I'm acting weird. She's lining up allies, Juanita, you understand? She's telling everyone how lousy I am because she wants folks on her side when she files for divorce. The battle lines are already drawn. It's inevitable. You're giving up. I'm surrendering. Total, unconditional." Sunday just happened to be the second Sunday of the month, a day Mac hated above all others. Lisa's family, the Bunning clan, was required by law to meet at her parents' home for an after-church brunch the second Sunday of every month. No excuses were tolerated, unless a family member happened to be out of town, and even then such an absence was frowned upon and usually subjected the missing one to withering gossip, outside the presence of the children, of course. Mac, his forehead an even deeper shade of blue, and the swelling still evident, couldn't resist the temptation of a final, glorious farewell. He skipped church, decided to neither shower nor shave, dressed himself in old jeans and a soiled sweatshirt, and for dramatic effect removed the white gauze that covered his wound so that the entire brunch would be ruined when all the Bunnings saw his gruesome stitches. He arrived just a few minutes late, but early enough to prevent the adults from enjoying a few preliminary rounds of excoriating chit-chat. Lisa completely ignored him, as did almost everyone else. His daughters hid in the sunroom with their cousins, who, of course, had heard all about the scandal and wanted details about his crack-up. At one point, just before they were seated at the table, Lisa brushed by him and through gritted teeth managed to utter, "Why don't you just leave?" To which Mac cheerfully responded, "Because I'm starving, and I haven't had a burnt casserole since the second Sunday of last month." All were present, 16 total, and after Lisa's father, still wearing his white shirt and tie from church, blessed the day with his standard petition to the Almighty, they passed the food and the meal began. As always, about 30 seconds passed before her father began discussing the price of cement. The women drifted off into little side pockets of gossip. Two of Mac's nephews across the table just stared at his stitches, unable to eat. Finally, Lisa's mother, the Grande Dame, reached the inevitable point at which she could no longer hold her tongue. During a lull, she announced at full volume, "Mac, your poor head looks dreadful. That must be painful." Mac, anticipating just such a salvo, shot back, "Can't feel a thing.
I'm on some wonderful drugs. What happened? The question came from the brother-in-law, the doctor, the only other person at the table with access to Mac's hospital records. There was little doubt the doctor had practically memorized Mac's charts, grilled the attending physicians, nurses, and orderlies, and knew more about Mac's condition than he did himself. As Mac made his plans to exit the legal profession, perhaps his only regret was that he had never sued his brother-in-law for medical malpractice. Others certainly had, and collected. I'd been drinking, Mac said proudly. Came home late, slipped on some ice, hit my head. Spine stiffened in unison around the table from the fiercely teetotaling family. Mac pressed on. Don't tell me you guys haven't heard all the details. Lisa was an eyewitness. She's told everyone. Mac, please, Lisa said as she dropped her fork. All forks were suddenly still, except for Mac's. He plunged his into a pile of rubber chicken and stuffed it into his mouth. Please what? He said, mouth full, chicken visible. You've made sure that every person at this table knows your version of what happened. He was chewing, talking, and pointing his fork at his wife, who was at the other end of the table close to her father. And you probably told them all about our visit to the marriage counselor, right? Oh, my God, Lisa gasped. And I'm sleeping at the office? Don't we all know that? He said. Can't go home anymore, because, well, hell, I might slip and fall again. Or whatever, I might get drunk and beat my kids. Who knows? Right, Lisa? That's enough, Mac, her father said, the voice of authority. Yes, sir. Sorry. This chicken is practically raw. Who cooked it? His mother-in-law bristled. Her spine stiffened even more. Her eyebrows arched. Well, I did, Mac. Any more complaints about the food? Oh, tons of complaints, but what the hell? Watch your language, Mac, her father said. See what I mean? Lisa said, leaning in low. He's cracking up. Most of them nodded gravely. Helen, their younger daughter, began crying softly. You love to say that, don't you? Mac yelled from his end. You said the same thing to the marriage counselor. You've said it to everyone. Mac bumped his head, and now he's losing his shit. Mac, I don't tolerate such language, her father said sternly. Please leave the table. Sorry, I'll be happy to leave. He rose and kicked back his chair. And you'll be delighted to know that I'll never be back. That'll give you all a thrill, won't it? The silence was thick as he left the table. The last thing he heard was Lisa saying, I'm so sorry. Monday, he walked around the square to the large and busy office of Harry Rex Vonner, a friend who was undoubtedly the nastiest divorce lawyer in Ford County. Harry Rex was a loud, burly brawler who chewed black cigars, growled at his secretaries, growled at the court clerks, controlled the dockets, intimidated the judges, and terrified every divorcing party on the other side. His office was a landfill, with boxes of files in the foyer, overflowing waste baskets, stacks of old magazines in the racks, a thick layer of blue cigarette smoke just below the ceiling, another thick layer of dust on the furniture and bookshelves, and, always, a motley collection of clients waiting sadly near the front door. The place was a zoo. Nothing ran on time. Someone was always yelling in the back. The phones rang constantly. The copier was always jammed and so on. Mac had been there many times before on business, and he loved the chaos of the place. Heard you cracking up, boy, Harry Rex began as they met at his office door. The room was large, windowless, and situated at the back of the building, far away from the waiting clients. It was filled with bookshelves, storage boxes, trial exhibits, enlarged photos, and stacks of thick depositions, and the walls were covered with cheap matted photos, primarily of Harry Rex holding rifles and grinning over slain animals. Mac could not remember his last visit, but he was certain nothing had changed. They sat down, Harry Rex behind a massive desk with sheets of paper falling off the sides, and Mac in a worn canvas chair that tottered back and forth. I just busted my head, that's all, Mac said. You look like hell. Thanks. Has she filed yet? No, I just checked. She said she'll use some gal from Tupelo. Can't trust anyone around here. I'm not fighting Harry Rex. She can have everything. The girls, the house, and everything in it.
I'm filing for bankruptcy, closing up shop, and moving away.
Harry Rex slowly cut the end off another black cigar, then shoved it into the corner of his mouth.
You are cracking up, boy.
Harry Rex was about 50, but seemed much older and wiser. To anyone younger, he habitually added the word boy as a term of affection.
Let's call it a midlife crisis. I'm 42 years old, and I'm fed up with being a lawyer. The marriage ain't working, neither is the career. It's time for a change, some new scenery.
Look, boy, I've had 3 marriages. Getting rid of a woman ain't no reason to tuck tail and run.
I'm not here for career advice, Harry Rex. I'm hiring you to handle my divorce and bankruptcy. I've already prepared the paperwork. Just get one of your flunkies to file everything and make sure I'm protected.
Where are you going?
Somewhere far away. I'm not sure right now, but I'll let you know when I get there. I'll come back when I'm needed. I'm still a father, you know.
Harry Rex slumped in his chair. He exhaled and looked around at the piles of files stacked haphazardly on the floor around his desk. He looked at his phone with 5 red lights blinking.
Can I go with you? He asked.
Max said, sorry, you gotta stay here and be my lawyer. I have 11 active divorce files, almost all uncontested, plus 8 bankruptcies, 1 adoption, 2 estates, 1 car wreck, 1 workers' comp case, and 2 small business disputes. Total fees of about $25,000 over the next 6 months. I'd like you to take them off my hands.
It's a pile of crap.
Yes, the same stuff I've been shoveling for 17 years. Dumping on one of your little associates back there and give him a bonus. Believe me, there's nothing complicated about it.
How much child support can you stand?
Max is $3,000 a month, which is a hell of a lot more than I contribute now. Start at $2,000 and see how it goes. Irreconcilable differences? She can file, I'll join in. She gets full custody, but I get to see the girls whenever I'm in town. She gets the house, her car, bank accounts, everything. She's not involved in the bankruptcy. The joint assets are not included.
What are you bankrupting?
The law offices of Jacob McKinley Stafford, LLC. May it rest in peace.
Harry Rex chewed the cigar and looked at the petition for bankruptcy. There was nothing remarkable about it. The usual run-up on credit cards, the ever-present unsecured line of credit, the burdensome mortgage.
You don't have to do this, he said. This stuff is manageable.
The petition has already been prepared, Harry Rex. The decision has been made, along with several others. I'm bolting, okay? Out of here. Gone.
Pretty gutsy.
No, most folks would say that running away is the act of a coward.
How do you see it?
I could not care less. If I don't leave now, then I'll be here forever. This is my only chance.
Attaboy.
At precisely 10 a.m. Tuesday, one glorious week after the first phone call, Mac made the second. As he punched the numbers, he smiled and congratulated himself on the amazing accomplishments of the past 7 days. The plan was working perfectly. Not a single hitch so far, except perhaps the head wound, but even that had been skillfully woven into the escape. Mac was hurt, hospitalized with a blow to the head. No wonder he's acting weird.
Mr. Marty Rosenberg, he said pleasantly, then waited until the great man was notified. He answered quickly, and they exchanged preliminaries.
Marty seemed unhurried, willing to go with the flow of meaningless chatter, and Mac was suddenly worried that this lack of efficiency would lead to a change in plans. Some bad news? He decided to get to the point.
Say, Marty, I've met with all 4 of my clients, and as you might guess, they're all anxious to accept your offer. We'll put this baby to sleep for $500,000.
Yes, well, was it $500,000, Mac? He seemed uncertain.
Mac's heart froze and he gasped.
Of course, Marty, he said, then added a fake chuckle as if old Marty here was up to another prank. You offered $100,000 for each of the 4, plus $100,000 for the cost of defense.
Mac could hear papers being yanked around up in New York.
Let's see, Mac. We're talking about the Tenzo cases, right?
That's right, Marty, Mac said with no small amount of fear and frustration.
And desperation.
The man with the checkbook wasn't even sure what they were talking about.
1 week earlier, he'd been perfectly efficient. Now he was floundering. Then the most horrifying statement of all.
I'm afraid I've got these cases confused with some others. You gotta be kidding, Mac barked, much too sharply.
Be cool, he told himself.
We really offered that much for these cases, Marty said,
obviously scanning notes while he talked.
Damn right you did, and I, in good faith, conveyed the offers to my clients. We got a deal, Marty. You made a reasonable offer. We accept it. You can't back out now.
Just seems a little high, that's all. I'm working on so many of these product liability cases these days.
Well, congratulations, Mac almost said. You have tons of work to do for clients who can pay you tons of money.
Mac wiped sweat from his forehead and saw it all slipping away.
Don't panic, he said to himself.
It's not high at all, Marty. You should see Odell Grove with only one eye, and Gerald Baker minus his left hand, and Doug Jumper with his mangled and useless right hand, and Travis Johnson with little nubs where his fingers used to be. You should talk to these men, Marty, and see how miserable their lives are, how much they've been damaged by Tenzo chainsaws. And I think you'd agree that your offer of $500,000 is not only reasonable, but perhaps a bit on the low side.
Mac exhaled and almost smiled to himself when he finished. Not a bad closing argument. Maybe he should have spent more time in the courtroom.
I don't have time to hash out these details or argue liability, Mark. It's Mac.
Mac Stafford, attorney at law, Clanton, Mississippi.
Right, sorry.
More papers shuffled in New York. Muted voices in the background as Mr. Rosenberg directed other people. Then he was back, his voice refocused.
You realize, Mac, that Tenzo has gone to trial four times with his chainsaw and won every trial? Slam dunk, no liability.
Of course Mac did not know this because he'd forgotten about his little class action. But in desperation he said,
Yes, and I've studied those trials.
But I thought you were not going to argue liability, Marty.
Okay, you're right. I'll fax down the settlement documents.
Mac breathed deeply.
How long before you can get them back to me, Marty asked.
Couple of days.
They haggled over the wording of the documents. They went back and forth about how to distribute the money. They stayed on the phone for another 20 minutes doing what lawyers are expected to do. When Mac finally hung up, he closed his eyes, propped his feet on his desk, and kicked back in his swivel rocker. He was drained, exhausted, still frightened, but quickly getting over it. He smiled and was soon humming a Jimmy Buffett tune. His phone kept ringing.
The truth was, he had not been able to locate either Travis Johnson or Doug Jumper. Travis was rumored to be out west driving a truck, something he evidently could do with only seven full-length fingers. Travis had an ex-wife with a house full of kids and a ledger full of unpaid child support. She worked a night shift in a convenience store in Clanton and had few words for Mac. She remembered his promises to collect some money when Travis lost part of three fingers. According to some sketchy friends, Travis had fled a year earlier and had no plans to return to Ford County. Doug Jumper was rumored to be dead. He had gone to prison in Tennessee on assault charges and had not been seen in 3 years. He had never had a father. His mother had moved away. There were some relatives scattered around the county, but as a whole, they showed little interest in talking about Doug and even less interest in talking to a lawyer, even one wearing hunter's camouflage or faded jeans and hiking boots or any of the other ensembles Mac used to blend in with the natives. His well-practiced routine of dangling the carrot of some vague check payable to Doug Jumper did not work. Nothing worked. And after 2 weeks of searching, Mac finally gave up when he heard for the third or fourth time the rumor, that boy's probably dead. He obtained the legitimate signatures of Odell Grove and Gerald Baker, Gerald's being little more than a pathetic wiggle across the page with his right hand, and then committed his first crime. Notarizations on the settlement release forms were required by Mr. Marty Rosenberg up in New York, but this was standard practice in every case. Mac had fired his notary, though, and procuring the services of another was far too complicated. At his desk, with the doors locked, Mac carefully forged Frieda's name as a notary public, then applied the notary seal with an expired stamp he'd kept in a locked file cabinet. He notarized Odell's signature, then Gerald's, then stopped to admire his handiwork. He had been planning this deed for days now, and he was convinced he would never be caught. The forgeries were beautiful. The altered notary stamp was scarcely noticeable,
and no one up in New York would take the time to analyze them. Mr. Rosenberg and his crack staff were so anxious to close their files that they would glance at Mac's paperwork, confirm a few details, then send the check. His crimes grew more complicated when he forged the signatures of Travis Johnson and Doug Jumper. This, of course, was justified, since he had made good faith efforts to find them, and if they ever surfaced, he would be willing to offer them the same $25,000 he was paying to Odell and Gerald, assuming, of course, that he was around when they surfaced. But Mac had no plans to be around. The next morning, he used the U.S. Postal Service, another possible violation of law, federal, but again, nothing that troubled him, and sent the package by express to New York. Then Mac filed for bankruptcy, and in the process broke another law by failing to disclose the fees that were on the way from his chainsaw masterpiece. It could be argued, and perhaps it would be argued if he got caught, that the fees had not yet been collected and so forth, but Mac could not even win this debate with himself. Not that he really tried. The fees would never be seen by anyone in Clanton or Mississippi, for that matter. He hadn't shaved in 2 weeks, and in his opinion, the salt-and-pepper beard was rather becoming. He stopped eating and stopped wearing coats and ties. The bruises and stitches were gone from his head. When he was seen around town, which was not that often, folks hesitated and whispered because word was hot on the streets that poor Mac was losing it all. News of his bankruptcy raced through the courthouse, and when coupled with the news that Lisa had filed for divorce, the lawyers and clerks and secretaries talked of little else. His office was locked during business hours and after. His phones went unanswered. The chainsaw money was wired to a new bank account in Memphis, and from there it was quietly dispersed. Mac took $50,000 in cash, paid off Odell Grove and Gerald Baker, and felt good about it. Sure, they were entitled to more, at least under the terms of the long-forgotten contracts Mac had shoved under their noses when they had hired him. But at least for Mac, the occasion called for a more flexible interpretation of said contracts, and there were several reasons. First, his clients were very happy. Second, his clients would certainly squander anything above $25,000, so in the interest of preserving the money, Mac argued that he should simply keep the bulk of it. Third, $25,000 was a fair settlement in light of their injuries, and especially in light of the fact that the two would have received nothing if Mac had not been shrewd enough to dream up the chainsaw litigation scheme in the first place. Reasons 4, 5, and 6 followed the same line of thinking. Mac was already tired of rationalizing his actions. He was screwing his clients, and he knew it. He was now a crook, forging documents, hiding assets, swindling clients. And if he allowed himself to brood on these actions, he would have been miserable. The reality was that Mac was so thrilled with his escape that he caught himself laughing at odd times. When the crimes were done, there was no turning back, and this pleased him too. He handed Harry Rex a check for $50,000 to cover the initial fallout from the divorce, and he executed the necessary papers to allow his lawyer to act on his behalf in tidying up his affairs. The rest of the money was wired to a bank in Central America. The last act in his well-planned and brilliantly executed farewell was a meeting with his daughters. After several testy phone conversations, Lisa had finally relented and agreed to allow Mac to enter the house for 1 hour on a Thursday night. She would leave, but return in exactly 60 minutes. Somewhere in the unwritten rules of human behavior, a wise person once decided that such meetings are mandatory. Mac certainly could have skipped it, but then he was not only a crook, but also a coward. No rule was safe. He supposed it was important for the girls to have the chance to vent, to cry, to ask why. He need not have worried. Lisa had so thoroughly prepped them that they could barely manage a hug. He promised to see them as often as possible, even though he was leaving town. They accepted this with more skepticism than he thought possible. After 30 long and awkward minutes, Mac squeezed their stiff bodies one more time and hurried to his car. As he drove away, he was convinced the three women were planning a happy new life without him. And if he had allowed himself to dwell on his failures and shortcomings, he could have become melancholy. He fought the urge to remember the girls when they were smaller and life was happier. Or had he ever been truly happy? He really couldn't say. He returned to his office, entered, as always now, through the rear door, and gave the place one final walkthrough. All active files had been delivered to Harry Rex. The old ones had been burned. The law books, office equipment, furniture, and cheap art on the wall had either been sold or given away. He loaded up one medium-sized suitcase, the contents of which had been carefully selected. No suits, ties, dress shirts, jackets, dress shoes. All that garb had been given to charity. Mac was leaving with the lighter stuff. He took a bus to Memphis, flew from there to Miami, then on to Nassau, where he stayed one night before catching a flight to Belize City, Belize. He waited an hour in the sweltering airport there, sipping a beer from the tiny bar, listening to some rowdy Canadians talk excitedly about bone fishing, and dreaming of what was ahead. He wasn't really sure what was ahead, but it was certainly far more attractive than the wreckage behind. The money was in Belize, a country with a U.S. extradition treaty that was more formal than practical. If his trail got hot, and he was supremely confident it would not, then Mac would quietly ease on down to Panama. His odds of getting caught were less than slim, in his opinion, and if someone began poking around Clanton, Harry Rex would know it soon enough.